Thank you very much indeed for those words of welcome. It's a joy to be back again in Newton Arch Free Presbyterian Church. It's 6.5 years since I was here the last time. Now, you'll forgive me for not standing while we were singing the hymns, because I have a game leg, as they say in Ireland. And I thought, when I get up to speak, I have to stand and they'll all be sitting sleeping, so I might as well sit now. Yes, 6.5 years, if some of you will remember, that I came into the church in a very heavy overcoat because I had terrible malaria at that time. I had malaria over 40 times, but that was one of the worst because I couldn't shake it off. Right through to the end of February, when I thought it was free, it came back. And then I took more medicine and it came back again. And on top of that, I developed pneumonia and I had a very bad chest infection. One day I went to visit friends in Lurgan and they said, no, you're not going to the table for lunch, you're going to the emergency. And they took x-rays, sent me for a scan, gave me medicines. And then the doctor who was attending me there, he said, well, just to finalize things, there's some breathing exercises that we'd like you to do in Dungannon Hospital. That suited me fine because I knew the doctor who would attend me there, Dr. Baird. Well, after he'd examined me and done the exercise, he said, your chest is cleared up, your lungs have cleared up, but don't get up. I was going to go. He said, don't get up. The nurse is going to come and just take a routine blood test. I was back in Brazil 2 weeks when the phone rang, and it was a doctor from Dungannon. He said, I got the results of your blood tests, and you have to see a hematologist tomorrow. And I look back today, and I say, blessed malaria, blessed pneumonia, all things work together for good. Because if I hadn't had those diseases, I wouldn't have had the blood test. And the blood test revealed that I had multiple myeloma, a disease of the bone marrow, and that diagnosis was made at a very early stage. So all things really do work together for good to them who love the Lord. Recently, a very good friend in Brazil who does a wonderful work in the schools teaching the children and the staff the way of salvation received a diagnosis of cancer. And she was stunned. She was afraid. She was worried. She was preoccupied. She was depressed. And what made it worse, people would come and say, you know, you're a Christian, so you can't be depressed. You're a Christian, you can't be afraid, you can't be worried. But that was not the experience of the Apostle Paul. That was not his experience. Now, the Apostle Paul met the Lord in a spectacular way in 4 occasions. I think there are 4 occasions when the Lord appeared to Paul. First of all, on the road to Damascus, when he saw a light from heaven, and the Lord spoke to him, and Paul's life was changed and transformed, and he was saved by God's grace. I look back today, and I thank God for God's saving grace in my life. I never saw a light from heaven. The only light I saw from heaven was the day my brother hit me on the head with a milk bottle. But I heard a voice thundering in the pulpit, because for several months I had been attending the Ravenhill Free Presbyterian Church back in 1952. On the 13th of July, I raised my hand and indicated my desire to become a Christian. But I remembered that my cousin was in the meeting, and so I got out the door as quick as I could. The next Sunday evening, the 20th of July, I went back, I went into the inquiry room, and I asked the Lord to come into my life and save me. Now, I was the youngest of 5. So I thought, I'm not going to say anything at home. And I didn't. Until Thursday night, my mother pointed at me and said, you got converted. I said, how did you know? Who told you? She said, nobody told me. I saw the difference. So I praise God that his saving grace, I was 14. I praise God for his saving grace can change your life when you're only 14, that others know the difference. And that's the gospel that we go to preach in Brazil today. I came home at the end of March, and the day before I left, a young man came to visit me, spent the whole afternoon with me. He was just out of jail for murder. But before that, he had escaped from jail. He got away to Manasseh and lived under a false name for some time. But through the ministry of missionaries originally from Ballygar and Harry Reid, he came to know the Lord as Savior. And then he said, I'm living under a false name. I have to go back and give myself up. He came back to Rio Branco. He was put in jail. He got a heavy sentence. But now he's been released. And he was there just wanting to talk about the Lord and the Lord's salvation. The gospel is still the power of God unto those who believe. But then Paul had three other experiences when he met with the Lord. He met with the Lord, or the Lord met with him. We read in Acts 18, and the Lord appeared unto him by night and said, fear not. In Acts chapter 23, and the night following, the Lord stood by him and said, be of good cheer. And then in Acts 27, we read that the Lord appeared to him by night and said, fear not. On two occasions, Paul was afraid. And on the other occasion, Paul was depressed and discouraged. So the Lord had to say, the first thing he said was, cheer up, Paul. Cheer up, Paul. And I want you to look at those verses in Acts chapter 23, verse 11. And the night following, the Lord stood by him and said, be of good cheer, Paul. For as thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome. And then just verse 16, and when Paul's sister's son heard of their lying in wait, he went and entered into the castle and told Paul. And the Lord bless his word to our hearts. The night, the Lord said, fear not. The night following, the Lord said, be of good cheer. And the night, during the night, the Lord said, Paul, fear not. It's interesting how we face our problems in the daytime. But when night comes, it's a different story. Sometimes they come back so often, we lie there and we turn them over in our mind and we turn them over in our hearts and the sleep goes from us. Victor Maxwell said, when you can't sleep, don't count sheep, talk to the shepherd. Sometimes we don't always do that. If you're afraid during the day of the future, how much worse it seems to be at night. Now, during the many years I've been in Brazil, entering my 56th year now, more than any other missionaries, I've walked through the forest, spent days in the forest, slept in the middle of the jungle, lay down in the jungle, trail at night and slept there. And on different occasions, on two occasions, during the day, I came in contact with the spotted leopard. It's the biggest animal in the Brazilian Amazon rainforest, but it can be very dangerous and very vicious. I heard of a missionary who met the leopard face to face, and he didn't know what to do because he only had his Bible. He had no gun and nothing with him. And so he bowed his head and started to pray that the Lord would protect him, waiting for the leopard to jump on him. Nothing happened. So he opened his eyes very slowly, and he looked. And the leopard had its head bowed and its eyes closed. Oh, he said, well, what a miracle. The leopard's praying. The leopard said, I'm not praying. I'm just saying grace before I have my dinner. But at night, during the day, all right, I met them once. I could almost just reach out and touch it. It came so close. But at night, it's a different story. I still remember very clearly traveling in one of the rivers by canoe. I was with an American mission. It was a terrible journey. It took us 6 days to get to where I lived. And we were rowing. We didn't know how to row. The canoe was old, and every now and then we had to stop to bail the water out. But when night time came, when 6 in the evening came, we had to look for somewhere at the side of the river to put our hammocks up to pass the night. Well, on one occasion we came to an abandoned house. I can still see it in my mind because it was very high up. The bank of the river was there. It was getting dark. We had no longer batteries in our torches. We had no kerosene in our hurricane lamp. So we had to get up quick and get our hammocks up before the darkness came. We took a few things that we needed most. We got up. There was only 2 walls in the house in an L shape. And the forest was already growing in all around it. We got our hammocks up. We opened a tin of corned beef. We mixed it with the Brazilian mandioc root, ground mandioc root. We had our supper. And while we were having it, Arnie turned to me and he said, why was this house abandoned? I said, I know why it was abandoned. The fellow who lived here used to come into town occasionally, but he went out to cut rubber one day, and he didn't come back. And his wife went to look for him, in the afternoon, and she hadn't gone very far, just a short distance from the house, she found what was left of him, the spotted leopard had pulled him to pieces. That's why. So my colleague said, why don't we pray? And he started praying, he was praying so nicely, and he stopped. He said, have you got malaria? I said, no. He said, well, why are you shaking? I said, I'm shaking because if that leopard's still prowling round this house, all we have to defend ourselves is two spoons and a tin opener. That's why I'm shaking. At night, it was a different story. And here was Paul, it said, the night falling. The night falling what? The night falling had lost his temper. When he should have given his testimony to the Jews, he insulted the high priest. They were going to pull him apart. And he's in the prison now and he's thinking, why did I do it? Why did I not control myself? Why am I here, Lord? I could be out preaching the gospel. Why am I in this prison and what's going to happen to me? And I know he was depressed and down because the first word of the Lord said, be of good cheer. In other words, it was an expression that the Lord used on many occasions. Take courage, Paul. Take courage. When the disciples were in the storm and they were afraid and they thought the boat was going to sink and the Lord came to them on the water, he said, take courage. The same expression. The same word. He recalled that experience. He said, no one stood with me. Everybody abandoned me. Demons loved this present world. I was all on my own. Have you ever been in an experience like that? When at night and you're worried about your situation, you think nobody understands what I'm going through. I'm here all on my own. And what will my future be? But the Lord turned Paul's nightmare into a miracle. He said, Paul, be of good cheer, take courage. As you have testified in Jerusalem, you'll testify also in Rome. And three things happened that night to change Paul's nightmare and his fears and his depression into the miracle that only Christ can work in our lives. First of all, the Lord stood by him. The Lord stood by him. Now, I don't know if Paul actually saw the Lord, if he could see him with his eyes, but he knew the Lord was there. He knew his presence was there. He knew the Lord was beside him that night, and the Lord was speaking to him. He was aware of the Lord's presence. And sometimes when we're in trouble and we aren't going well, we don't realize that the Lord is there with us. One of the oldest members of the Martyrs Memorial, Mrs. Baird, a relation to the doctor I mentioned in Dungannon, was saved through an evangelist by the name of Whitman. And Whitman went to England to have an evangelistic campaign. Pastor Harvey Shaw tells a story in a book that he has written. And he said that Whitman approached a farmer, used his field, put up a tent, and had gospel meetings in that tent for many weeks. One of the first persons who got saved was the farmer's wife. And the farmer was very annoyed, very angry. He said, he came to destroy my life. My wife won't go gambling with me. She won't go drinking with me. She won't go dancing with me. All she wants to do is go to the meetings. I would like to kill that evangelist. Every night, Whitman would walk early to the tent to open it up and get ready. And he was down the lane early on his own. The mission ended. When he came back to that area a year later, he went to visit the farmer. And the farmer said, you know, I was determined to kill you. And one night I sat behind the hedge with the gun. And I saw you coming, and just as I got the gun pointed at you and was about to pull the trigger, your friend stepped between you and me and the gun. And I run further down the field, and I got a position again behind the hedge, and when I got ready to pull the trigger, your friend appeared again and stood between us. But Whitman said, I was never had a friend. I always walked alone. But the Lord was walking with them and stood between them. And stood beside him. Samuel Rutherford was in prison because of his faith. And he wrote to his church and he said, last night the Lord stood with me in this prison cell. And it seemed that every brick in the wall was made of gold. Because of the Lord's presence, everything glowed. William Cooper was a Christian, but very prone to depression. And on a dark winter, bitterly night, he decided the only thing to do was to go to the London Bridge and throw himself over and get it all over with. And so he called a cab and said, "Take me to the London Bridge." They set out in the darkness, but the fog got worse and worse and worse. And they traveled for 2 hours, and then the driver stopped and he said, "Look, I can't go any further. I can't go any further. I don't know where we are. I don't know where we've been. I can't see a thing." And Cooper said, "I'll walk to the London Bridge." And he got out and he took a few steps forward. And he realized then that they'd gone round in a circle and the Lord had directed him right back. He stopped the car right outside his own front door. And in the darkness, in the fog, God's hand was upon him and bringing him right back to where he had set off. Well, did he write later on, "You fearful saints, stress, courage, take. The cloud you so much dread, rich with blessings, and will break in blessings on your head." I recently proved that the Lord is with us in darkness. In the first week of November, I had deep vein thrombosis due to medicine that I was taking for the myeloma. I had deep vein thrombosis, not of one vein, but of all the veins in my left leg. The leg was so swollen that I couldn't bend my knee. My knee disappeared. I didn't know where my knee was anymore. It was just so swollen. Dr. Tom Geddes was there. He said, "Your leg just looks like a telegraph pole. Whatever you do, stay away from dogs." But I had could not get stand on my feet or walk out on this anywhere because of the pain. And the blood all seemed to stay in my leg and didn't come back. And then my blood pressure got out of control and I was really very sick. But I was always conscious that the Lord was with me. After 1 month, the swelling had gone down just a little bit, but I could bend my knee and I could stand. And so I called the driver of the hospital car, came to see me, and he said, "What do you want?" I said, "I want a wheelchair and an extinguisher to push it." And he looked at me and said, "Why?" I said, "I can stand, I can bend my knee, I can walk just a few paces, but I can walk, and I have to go to the bank." Now, I had it in my mind in those days to send a Christmas gift to the pastor who had a very small church. And he would have no extra perks, nothing extra at Christmas. And somehow the Lord put it on my heart. It has to be today. It has to be today. I said, "But if I waited for another week, my leg would be better. If I waited for 2 weeks, it would still be a few days before Christmas. 10 days, it had to be the day." Well, they got me to the bank with a bit of struggle. I made the transfer. I came home again, got my leg up in front of me, sitting there. And about an hour later, the phone rang. I told people not to ring me because I couldn't get to the phone. But I staggered over and picked it up, and it was the pastor. I said, "Pastor, how did you get my phone number?" Because he didn't have it. He said, "Never mind. Who were you talking to? Do you know what happened to me?" I said, "No, what happened to you?" He said, "Well, last week the baby was sick. I had to take the baby to the hospital. I borrowed my father's car. I had an accident. I ran into another car. The car was then being repaired. And it was coming out of the repair shop today, but only if I could pay the bill. And if I couldn't pay the bill, then I'd have to rent a car for the other driver until I could pay the bill. And I told the church I should pray. Nobody in the church had money to lend me. Family didn't have money to lend me. Nobody had any money. And I thought this morning it's hardly worthwhile even going into the bank. But when I went in, the money was there. The transfer had gone through. And I said, Lord, thank you for directing me. If I'd left it for a week, it was complicated his life. I didn't know anything about his sickness. If I'd left it for 2 weeks, it would be even worse. I being in the way the Lord led me, and he was there with me, even in those hours of pain and darkness. Well, yes, we sing, "Standing somewhere in the shadows, you'll find Jesus." But he's not standing in the shadows to hide. He's standing in the shadows of your life. Standing in the shadows of my life. And when the dark moments came and the difficulties come, we need to look to the Lord and realize that he said, "I'll never leave thee nor forsake thee." And the Lord spoke to him. The Lord said, "Paul, cheer up. be of good cheer. I don't know again if he heard an actual voice, but he knew the Lord was speaking, and the Lord knew the language that Paul understood best and spoke in that language. Paul spoke many different languages, but the message was very clear, and Paul understood the message. And God speaks to us when we seek his face. He speaks to us sometimes through a message that we hear, through a testimony, through circumstances, through his word. And sometimes in the silence of our heart, the Lord speaks to us. Bill Pethidge was a missionary for many years, and he was going for surgery. And he was lying in the ward, and when the door opened in that morning, he heard the trolley coming in, and he knew they were coming for him. So he said, Lord, give me a verse that will help me. And he opened his Bible and put his finger on a verse. He said, Lord, this is the verse that will help me. And he looked at it. He put his finger on the verse and said, blessed are the dead that die in the Lord. But that's not the way that the Lord speaks to us. He speaks to us as we read his word. He speaks to us sometimes in our hearts. Christian Rigger, in 1940, was a young Christian man in Germany. And he was taken prisoner because he refused to join Hitler's army and sympathize with Hitler's principles. During the 4 years that he was in jail, he would receive one letter each year from his wife. After 1 year, the letter arrived, but it arrived on the hour that he was being taken out to be interrogated. And that would be a terrifying experience because they could torture him, dictate the names and addresses, and betray other people in his church who had the same views as he had. But he hurriedly read his wife's letter. And she'd read and terminated with Acts 5, verse 41. They rejoiced that they were counted worthy to suffer for his name. Rejoice, you're counted worthy to suffer for his name. When he was going in to be questioned, another prisoner was coming out. They didn't know each other. He never saw him before, he never saw him afterwards. But they bumped into each other. And the prisoner put something in his pocket in that split second. He was in question. It wasn't so bad as he thought. They brought him back again to his cell. He remembered this something in his pocket. He took it out. It was a matchbox. But there was nothing in the matchbox. Just a piece of paper. And on it was written, Acts 5, verse 41. Read these words. Count it worthy to speak, to suffer for the Lord. And so God does speak to us. In a special way. It was a Tuesday morning. I was leaving the house at about 5 in the morning, and I put my shoulder bag on, and before I left I went over to the kitchen cupboard and I picked up a small tape recorder, and there were dozens of tapes lying there, audio tapes, and I put one in my bag and put it in with the tape recorder, walked a few blocks to the hospital, packed up some more medicines, did a ward round, saw the patients, wrote up their medication for that day. And then the car came to take me to Santa Madureira. It was about two and a half hours journey from the town. When they got to Santa Madureira, the paramedics there had the boat ready for me. We went down river. We attended people who had leprosy on that river, the River Yak, in various different places. And then we come out onto the main river, which is the River Peru, a big river. We went downriver, attended patients down there, and then we come up with several patients just up above the mouth of the Iaco River. We attended them. The last patient we came up to attend, I was first up the bank of the river, and I shouted back to the auxiliary nurse, I said, Julie, we're at the wrong place, there's no house here. He said, no, this is the right place. And then we got up a little bit further. There was only a piece of charred ground and a bit of twisted metal where their house had been. The patient was a boy of about 17. He had an ongoing ulcer on the sole of his foot. He lived with his mother and widowed mother and several younger brothers and sisters. And he had kids from one side. His mother and some of the children came from other sides. And they told me that their house had been burnt down on Christmas Eve. They got out with just the clothes that they were wearing. So I gave them the medicine that he needed, and the bandages and the ointment. And then I went round and I gave them all gospel literature, Gospel of John, a New Testament. And I waved goodbye and was going down the river bank. And I looked back and they were standing there with a Gospel of John, a New Testament, nowhere to live. He had lost his Wellington boots that he needed to protect his foot and that also when he would go down the muddy bank into the river to fish or out into the forest to work. And a verse of scripture came to my mind so forcibly. To him that knows to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. And I stopped and I thought and I said, Lord, if I help them to build a new house, all the other neighbors will be wanting me to help them. So I started to walk again, and it came again, to him that knows to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. And I stopped and I called the young man down into the boat, and I said, now, you're going to need so many boards to make the floor, so many boards to put up the wall. You're going to need boards to make a division inside. You're going to need boards, I don't know what you call them in this country, pernamite, as we call them, to hold the boards up and put the roof on. And the thatch you'll take from the forest to make the roof. You need nails. And what size of boots do you take? I said, why? I said, well, so when I get back to town today, I'm going to a lumber mill. And I'm going to pay for all this. And you get a friend who has a big canoe, and tomorrow morning at dawn, you leave and go up and collect all this, and it'll be a help to start you off to get a new house built. And he could hardly believe it. I said, yes, that's... I said, what was that bit of metal in the middle of the ruins? He said, that was our only possession. It was a two-burner gas stove. So we said goodbye, and we started upriver. I got out my tape recorder. I lay down on the floor with no more patients at 10, and I put it on, but before I turned it on, I prayed. I said, Lord, I didn't pray this morning or read your word because it was so early. And I just ask you now to just speak to me through this tape that I picked up here. And when I get back, I look up the reference. I can't remember where that verse is, but just show me, Lord, that I did the right thing in helping these people. And I put on the tape. A lovely hymn singing, choir, and the congregation, and then the pastor said, I'm going to read from James chapter 4, verse 17. To him that knoweth to do good, and doeth it not, to him it is sin. Just the Lord confirmed in my heart that day that what he had spoken earlier on. The preacher never even mentioned it in a sermon. I turned the tape recorder off and I called Julia, the nurse, and I said, you see that list? You'd better put on a two-burner gas stove. And he looked at me and he looked at the tape recorder. He said, what sort of a tape is that you've got? But the Lord had spoken. But the Lord not only spoke, the Lord gave him a promise. There would be storms to come. There would be poisonous snakes in his hand. There would be many, many things in Paul's life. But God gave him a promise. As thou hast testified in Jerusalem, so you must testify in Rome. And he held on to that promise. And when God speaks to us and we're in trouble and in need, we ask him, yes, Lord, give me a promise and I can hold on to it. Give me a promise that, Lord, I can go back and say, Lord, you said this and this is what you promised me. In 1967, I'd been 6.5 years in Brazil, and I had a letter written to my missionary society because I felt that I had to do something for people who had leprosy. And I didn't know whether to send that letter that day. In the letter I said, I'm not coming back to the work in the interior. I'm going to go to Manaus and stay there to study medicine. It seemed so ridiculous. I was 28. I was in a foreign country. I would be going to Manaus without financial recourses. The mission wouldn't be supporting me. And it seemed so ridiculous. But I said, yes, Lord. And I took it to the post office and sent it off. The lady in the post office called me back as I was going out. She said, the letter came for you last week and I forgot to give it to you. And I brought it home and it was a Christmas card. And somebody had written on that Christmas card at the top, where God's finger points, there God's hand will make the way. It wasn't a verse of scripture, but it was a biblical truth. Where God's finger points, God's hand will make the way. I went to Manaus. I had to take entrance exams to the university, the federal university, in Portuguese language, Portuguese literature, chemistry, physics, and biology. In my teens, I attended Belfast High School. And 3 times in a row in the physics exam, I took 0. The physics teacher wouldn't let me back in this class. And every time my report came home at the end of the term, my mother would open Bob's and just say, oh yes, you got a very good mark in art. You were first place in art. You'd open Brian's, 99 out of 100 in mathematics. But before she opened mine, she always took her shoe off. She said, you failed again. This is the stupid one in the family. And the only time I got a good mark in a French exam, I still got hammered. She said, you never got a mark like that in your life. You cheated. Don't be asked. It's none of your business. And of course, in those entering exams in Manasseh, I failed the physics exam. That was it. Now what are you going to do? I said, Lord, you said your hand would make a way. And I know somehow you're going to make the way. When all the exams were over, there were 8 places left over in the medical school that year. And the directors of the university decided that they would hold a second round of examinations. It never happened before. But that year they decided they would have a second round of examinations. And on the second round, I passed and was able to start my medical course. I was back in the university some time ago, about a couple of years ago, and I went into the department that deals with the entrance exams. I knew the doctor that was in charge. And I said, how many times did the university repeat the exams? He said, never. I said, oh yes, and in January of 68 they repeated them. He said, no they didn't. I said, yes they did. He said, no they didn't. I have it all here, the records here in the MOOC. There was only one series of examinations. I said, but I passed in the second round. He said, the book doesn't say that. The records say you passed in the first round of examinations. God's hand had made the way. Nobody understood. Yes, God gave him a promise, but God surrounded him. He not only spoke to him, he not only he stood by him, the Lord surrounded him. All those 40 men had themselves banded together to kill him. They would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. I think they were the founders of the Weight Watchers Club. But God put 470 soldiers around Paul that night. Just think of it. 470. There were men on horses all in the same night. There were soldiers on horses. There were soldiers in front of them. There were soldiers behind them. And he was taken away to safety. Here was a young man, we don't know his name. He was Paul's nephew. He stepped into Paul's life and revealed the plan, and God surrounded Paul that night. And sometimes we feel we're on our own. We do. Nobody knows anything of what we're going through. But God surrounds us with people who are praying, with people who are interested, that we don't know nothing about. Pastor Ron Dunn was a preacher in the United States. His 21-year-old son committed suicide. And on the first anniversary of that death, he asked the church, said, I'll not be taking part in the meetings today, but I'll be there in the evening service. And in the morning after they had their breakfast, he and his wife sat around the table, and they thought, well, all the memories will come back of that terrible day. But as they prayed, somehow there was a sweet presence of the Lord, and there was such a tranquility in their lives, they could hardly explain it. In the afternoon, they went out to the graveyard, and they stood around the grave, and they said again, as I feared going out there, that the Lord's presence was so real, and there was such a sense of peace in their hearts. In the evening, they were going into the church, and a woman who didn't know them, who had come from another town just a few days beforehand, she stopped and she said, Pastor, were you preaching at a special conference or something today? And he said, no, why? He said, because I was washing dishes this morning, and I just got such a burden and such an impression, I had to go and get down on my knees and pray for you. And that afternoon, I was doing my housework, and again, I had to go into my bedroom and close the door, and got down on my knees and prayed, because God was surrounding me with people who prayed that didn't know anything about him. In 1937, Molly Harvey and Willie McComb and Margaret went to the Acre Estate. The war came, they couldn't get home, and after about 8 years, Molly was called out on a maternity case very late one night. She realized after a short distance that she'd made a mistake. The man said, my wife's dying, there's no doctor, you're the only one can help. But he had other intentions, and she fought and fought and fought. Eventually, after he'd beaten her very severely, she managed to escape from his evil intentions by throwing herself in the river and was later rescued. When she came home, to Northern Ireland. She was first in England in the my mission hospital where she studied. And one of the nurses there said, "Molly, I promised to pray for you." And I did. I prayed for you every day since you left. But she said, "You know, one night I had a funny experience. 5 o'clock in the morning I woke and I couldn't go back to sleep. I had to get out of my bed, got down on my knees and I prayed. I tried to get up again. I prayed and I prayed and I prayed until I knew all was well. 5 o'clock in the morning, it was midnight in Rio Blanco, where I live, when that happened. And they looked at the calendar. And when Molly was struggling in the hand of an evil man, there was a woman in London on her knees praying for her. God surrounds us in our distress, in our dangers. A young man stepped into Paul's life, gave the message. Who was he? We don't know. But when we need someone, most of all, the Lord will surround us with someone who will stand in and say, "Be of good cheer." Many years ago, some number of years ago, I was going back to Brazil through the United States. And I traveled around to different towns in Brazil to attend the people and to operate. And I saw an advertisement of a portable operating microscope that I could take with me. And it would make the surgeries easier for me when I was operating people who were blind, people with cataract and things like that. And we made arrangements and I bought it in the United States. And then I traveled down to Miami. People told me that the best way to come into Brazil, if you're bringing anything like that, come to Leticia in Colombia, from Miami to Leticia. Leticia, you walk across the road. There's no customs. You're in Brazil. The other side of the road is Brazil. But what I didn't know was I had to stop over in the capital in Bogota. And in Bogota, they took the microscope from me and they took all my baggage and they put it in your room. It was about 3 a.m. It was very early. And I tried to explain them. The custom then wouldn't hear anything. They pushed me out into the airport lounge there, closed the door, the lights went off, and I stood there. I said, "Lord, what do? Do I go back to Brazil without any baggage? Do I stay here? I don't know how. I don't speak Spanish. I only speak Portuguese. It's similar and you can understand something, but where do I start even to try and get this out of the customs? What happens?" So I went to the airline desk. They said, "No, we can't do anything. Here's your boarding pass. We'll be calling the flight in about 30 minutes and you'll have to get on board the flight for the Leticia." And I prayed again and then I went back to the desk and I said, "Could I speak to the manager?" And the man got up and said, "Why?" And I explained. He said, "Come with me." He took me through the airline office, out into the patio where the planes were being refilled and refueled and loaded up to take off, right over on the left-hand side, the back there, right at the end. It was a custom shed, it was all in darkness. I said, "We can't get in." He said, "Yes, we can." And he pulled a lever, and the carousel that takes the baggage started going round. And he got down on his hands and knees and went in through the rubber flaps and called me to follow, and I did the same. And I ended up here in the room where they put my baggage, and they got it out and changed the baggage labels for Leticia, put them on the roadway that was going around there. And he was going out, the baggage was just about to go out, and I was following, and a customs man came running down in his uniform and shouting, "You can't do this. I know where you're going. You can't do this. I know where you're going." Those days I didn't have internet and all that. He said, "I'll send a radio message to Leticia, and I'll pick you up in Leticia." But it was too late. I was out on the airline path, and the man told the people, some porters to carry it over to the plane on the other side. He took me by the arm and said, "You come with me because you don't have time to go back up through the airport." He took me to the door of the plane and put me off. And I thought, maybe he didn't put it on the plane. Maybe he told them to take it home. I don't know. But when I got to Leticia, yes, the baggage was there. But there was a terrible hue and cry. Because the customs were there. And they were opening everybody's baggage. And everybody was complaining. They said, "But this is a national flight. They never do this." And the man in front of me said, "They're looking for something. They're looking for somebody." I said, "Oh, I wonder who it could be." And he was taking his suitcase off the counter. And he looked at me and he looked at the customs man. And he thought I was a priest. And he said, "Permit el padre passar. Permit el padre passar. Let the father go through." And I thought for a moment, the big man will kill me, but here goes. I said, gracias, gracias, gracias. Picked up my baggage and ran. Well, who was that man in Colombia, in the airport, international airport, that took me in on the carousel? Did he get into trouble? He was there when I needed. Who was that man in Leticia that thought I was a priest? Normally I would have choked him, but I thought he was so nice that day. Who was he? He was there when I needed him. I wasn't taking in contraband to Brazil. I was taking a microscope that I would travel around to different places. I went with a microscope in a little outpatient clinic outside Manaus in the old leprosy hospital. Senior José Major had been blind for 17 years. He had no fingers left on his hand. So at mealtime, he couldn't feel the spoon and he couldn't see it. Somebody had to put the food in his mouth. 17 years. And I rigged up the microscope in that little outpatient clinic and was able to remove the cataract and restore vision. Not great vision, but just enough to change the quality of life. Yes, I look back, I say, I'm one sinner saved by grace. And to thee, thy dying lamb, I all things owe. And all I have and all I know. Yes, the Lord is somebody to stand in our lives when we need him most. During my work as trying to eliminate leprosy from the Acre State, I had to travel from many different towns on the state, to travel by one motor propeller plane for hours sometimes across the jungle. And that was all the time. And I often used to say it's the prayers of God's people, the Lord's mercies and the prayers of God's people that protects us. Nine of the planes that I traveled in, and nine of the pilots came down, and everybody was killed. And two other pilots crashed twice, but they both got out, but not the passengers. And yet the Lord kept us. And the Lord was good to us. And I was trying to get through all the rivers that I had to travel in. And I said to one of the nurses one day, you know, if only there was a runway at the headwaters of one of these rivers, it would save me maybe 3-4 weeks going up river, and then I could tend the patients as we come down. I'd send the boat up, and they would be waiting for me. And she said, well, the river Iyako, at the headwaters, there's a rubber plantation, and they have a plane, and they have a runway. I said, but I don't think I could afford to pay just a plane just to fly me. She said, well, I'll find out. She came back a few days later, and she said, look, I spoke to the manager, and he said he'll fly you over the jungle free the day that you want to go. Just mark the day. So I said, there's a catch somewhere here, you know. But anyhow, I sent the boat upriver, and when I knew it would be there, or nearly there, I made arrangements to go. I went out to the manager's house. At the back of his house was a field, and a little, very small one-propeller plane. We took off, we flew for almost an hour and a half over the jungle, came down again on a field, and right enough the boat was there, and I went to thank him, and I said, I've no other business to do, I just came here to bring you here today, and then I'm turning around and going straight back to Rio Branco. And I thought, that's almost 3 hours flying, a private plane over the jungle. I said, well, how much do I owe you? He said, you don't owe me anything. I said, I don't owe you anything, no. He said, it's my privilege. He said, you know, when I was a small boy, I sort of made a promise, and today I'm fulfilling it. I said, well, tell me about it. What do you mean? He said, well, I'm not a Brazilian. I was born on an island off the coast of Africa. When I was 8 years of age, my family moved to Brazil. But on that island, I was so poor, and my family was so poor, I never had a shirt on my back. I never had even flip-flops on my feet. The only thing that I had was a pair of shorts. But there was a missionary on that island. And she did something for me one day. And showed me such kindness. And even as just a little boy of about 6, I said, one day I'll grow up and I'll get a job and I'll come back and I'll repay her for the kindness that she showed to me. But then we came to Brazil and I never was able to go back. So I'm paying back today another missionary. Oh, that's very interesting. And who was the missionary? Who said, oh, you wouldn't know her. She was from Ireland. Her name was Donna Jessie. I said, but I do know her. It was Jessie Munn from the Shore Road. She and her husband, Ernie Eads, worked in the Cape Verde Islands off the coast of Africa for many years. Her sister Lottie and her husband, Lottie Mon and her husband worked in the Cape Verde Islands for many years. Their sisters Emma and Janet and their brother Robert worked mainline Africa, but they worked on the islands. And something that Jesse had done to a little poverty-stricken boy on the other side of the world, 25 years beforehand, here was this man flying me for free over the jungle. He stepped into my life the day that I needed. Yes, the Lord surrounds us. And that was an important journey, because I had economized the time that I was spent going up the river. I was able, when we came down to the mouth of another river, the Makawan, we turned up there. We went right up to the headwaters, and right up at the headwaters of that other river, we attended the patients. But I wrote in my report, today, after we attended, we called the people together, and we had a meeting in one of the homes. We gathered the people in, and we'd sing Foina Cruz, you know, at the cross. And we would sing that, and the auxiliary nurse was a Christian, so he knew it, and the two of us would sing it. And then the people would maybe join in after a while, and then we'd speak to them about the Lord's salvation. I wrote in my journal that after the meeting, I pointed a young woman to Christ. How would she have heard away at the headwaters of that river? And how would I have gone if I'd gone up the river spending maybe 3 weeks? I then economized and had time to do the extra journey. Yes, God surrounds us. God stood by him. God spoke to him. And God surrounds us. And may the Lord bless us tonight. And thank you for your patience.